What a great week. What an amazing week. Global Leadership Summit was here. We had so many leaders getting better for the kingdom, but also better just for our community. We had a great week of student baptisms. So busy this week, in fact, that I forgot to get to the gym. So I hope you don't mind. I'm going to do a little exercise in between, do a little multitask this week. Good news, I've got about a good 30 seconds of reservoir still inside of me, so I won't be on the bicycle very long, so I really won't be that distracting. However, the deep breaths that follow will probably be a little bit more than you should be prepared for. I apologize. So this week, we're continuing in week two of this series we started last week, The Comparison Trap. The comparison trap is like legit. Like I tried to express last week, it's not just like this thing that keeps you from doing your best. Like it's this thing that keeps you from doing anything, Kingdom Land. Like the comparison trap has like been researched, it's been studied. It's maybe not phrased like that. We just talk about it more as a comparison. But the comparison trap we've kind of branded is a weapon that is used by our enemy to keep us from doing the very unique, specific purpose and destiny that God has called us to, because we get so distracted in what everybody else is doing, how they look, how they appear, and what it seems that they're out to accomplish. The comparison trap is actually attributed to really powerful kind of weapons and tools that are used against us. For example, like today, right now today, this day, estimated 300 million people will deal with depression. And in the Northern Hemisphere, we're not even into the gray months, to the winter months yet, where that spikes up really high. And through the studies that they've seen, through all the things in the research, like it would make sense that things like culture and age and gender and occupation, religion, economic status would feed into it. But one of the things that they've found most that feeds people into the state of depression is comparison. And how I compare to the people around me and the people that I see on television or social media and how I compare myself to others, what they have, what they do, what they feel like, what they look like. And it just spirals people into depression. Anxiety fits into the same category. Many people that struggle with anxiety do so triggered out of comparison. How I compare to that mom, to that employee, to that boss. It's just such a real and relevant thing. Low self-esteem triggered by comparison. People struggling to believe they can accomplish what they're supposed to accomplish because of the low self-esteem that's triggered through comparison. So my challenge in this series is, what if we could really recognize the attack of the enemy or spiritual enemy that's trying to keep us, prevent us from living out this call that God has had for us, that God has placed in us, this unique destiny that God has created us for? What if we could recognize the comparison trap before we moved any further down the road into things like depression, anxiety, or low self-esteem? Before we got any more wrapped up in what's going on into the lane to my right and the lane to my left, that we could really recognize it, be free from it, and live out this destiny that God has created us for? And the reality is, the more I was talking about it and thinking about it this week, the reality is that most of us live in a place right now today where much of our growth, where much of our history, where much of who we are has been in some way shaped by how we compared ourselves to other people. Example being, like, probably most of the music that you would say that you like has come from what you saw or listened with someone else, and because they liked it, you started to listen to more of it until you liked it. Like, I know some of the music some of y'all listen to. It's not good. But you've been around enough people that liked it, you thought you want to be more like them, so you came to like the music. The way we dress, like to follow the trends over the years, to go back in time. Once you're old enough to go back and look at the trends and how ridiculous you looked, it must have been that you thought someone else looked good dressing like that. They look pretty, they look handsome, so you dress like that. Growing up, I spent hundreds of dollars in shoes that I thought would make me run as fast as him or jump as high as him. It didn't work. We do so many of the things that we do, so many of the decisions, the pursuits, the motivation that we have, the occupation that so many of us pursued for so long was that we saw someone else succeed in it and we wanted success like they had, so we modeled after them and tried to do what they had done so that we could have what they have. Like for me, it boils down to like even the passion that I have for sports, specifically for competitive sports, like the sports where you have a ball and can keep score. Sorry to my gymnasts out. No, I'm just kidding. I'm not getting in a fight. I got booed off the stage last service. Stay on task. Sports are so competitive because it gives you real-time comparison of how you measure up to the competition and how we adjust and how we spend our money and spend our time and we train and we prepare. And as I've gotten older, I'm still as competitive as I once was. Every time I play euchre with my friends, I have to get saved again because I compromised. I just want to win. And as I've gotten older, my body has talked back to me and told me that I need to do sports and competitive things that are less impactful, specifically on my knees. So I've taken on the new sports of competing against myself on a bicycle that doesn't move. I've tried to be better at riding the stationary bike, to do exercises to stay in shape, but also to maybe not destroy my knees. And It's kind of triggered like the competitive gene in me again to watch and to tune into like other competitive cyclists. And in July was the Tour de France. And the Tour de France, that's how you say it when you're a real fan. The Tour de France was really competitive this year. There were some really gnarly accidents where lots of people piled up on top of each other. And the game, like you can't watch the whole thing. It's like a month, nobody. But I watched the highlights of the Tour de France. And what I learned was there are so many types of bikes and styles of bikes and brands of bikes. And in all the kinds of bikes and over the 200 riders that were riding their bikes, you know what I never saw? Was a bike like this. I mean, it's similar. It's got similar handles, similar seats, similar pedals. It's got these things that my feet don't really fit into. Like, it's similar in so many ways, but I've never seen a bike like this. Yet I see so many people, even so many believers, that get on a bike like this, and they get into the race where they see these other riders going past, and they see these other people doing their thing, and we see these other people succeed in their race. And we realize we can do nearly everything we can do in a competitive bike race right here. We can stand up, we can sit down, we can pedal, we can lean, we can get down serious like we're on a hill. We can do all the things except for one important thing. Go anywhere. And many of us are living out this call that God's put on our life right here. We're exhausted, we're wore out, we're sweating, we're burning the calories, we're stressing, we're thinking, we've got our mind wrapped around, how do I get ahead in this race? I'm not going anywhere. You see, comparison will wear you down without getting you any closer to the finish line. If you were here last week, we talked about this race that God has set before us, this unique, specific race that God has placed you in, and the path and the road that he's placed you in. And some of us, we get so wrapped up in trying to run in somebody else's lane and keep up with them, and instead we miss out on the fact that God has put us in a race and set us out to win the race. When we can't figure out why we can't get there, it could be because we're sitting on an exercise bike trying to compete in the Tour de France. We get caught up. We miss out. We think we're keeping up. We think we're keeping pace. We think we're staying in. But can I just be honest? Like, the comparison trap isn't just tough. The comparison trap is mean. Kind of like riding an exercise bike. Like, sometimes you're mean, buddy, okay? The comparison trap is mean. And that, if you're taking notes, I mean, the comparison trap is a thief of joy. Like, part of one of the great side effects of following after Jesus is that he fills us with fullness of joy. That knowing who you are and whose you are, that knowing what you were created to put on this planet to do, there is a joy that overwhelms that come with this. And the moment we move into comparison, joy is robbed from us because we can't keep up with the way they were, and we can't keep up with what they, and we can't keep up with where they live, what they do, what they wear, the things that we think are important. Comparison will destroy your joy. Comparison will steal your joy. I'm going to talk about this in 2 weeks. There's this correlation between joy and contentment. When I understand contentment, I can fully find joy. But when contentment is gone, I can't find joy. Contentment ends where comparison begins. When comparison starts, I no longer am content in where God has placed me, what God is doing in me, what God is doing through me. I start to live a life outside of those bounds. Number two, comparison is a manipulator of motivation. Comparison manipulates what motivates me. As a Christian, as a Christ follower, part of my responsibility, part of my draw is that I want to live a life that honors God. I want to be a husband that honors God. I want to be a dad that honors God. I want to be an employee that honors God. I want to be a boss that honors God. I want to do what is right in all that I do because doing what's right is a way to honor my God. But comparison causes me to live outside of those parameters. Comparison causes me to compromise the right stuff to do what I want to get more of what they have. Comparison, you may be like, nah, Pastor Luke, that's not me. Like, I understand comparison, but I don't really compromise. Yeah, we do. Because when we realize that what we've been doing and how we've been doing it and the integrity we've been living with is not getting us results like they have, we'll make compromises to get there. And we'll compromise, we'll water down our integrity. And we'll compromise and look the other way against things that maybe we know we should be aware of and not allow to happen. And we'll compromise the way we treat people. We even compromise the way we treat ourselves in efforts to try to do what they do to get where they are, to keep up and to keep pace. Last week we talked about a real specific passage from King Solomon, the wisdom that he shared in Ecclesiastes. He kind of gives us this observation of the people that he sees even back then and how that relates still to us today. Ecclesiastes chapter 4 and verse 4, he says, I observe that most people are motivated to success because they envy their neighbors, but this too is meaningless, like chasing the wind. When envy is our motivation, you will certainly compromise what's right to get what you want, what you think you want, because of what you've seen and observed in comparison. Number three, comparison is the thief of identity. God did not create you to be a copy of someone else. Sure, there are great people to look up to. There are all kinds of characters in the Bible that we can aspire to be similar to, but God did not create you to be a carbon copy of anybody else, nor did God create anybody else to be a carbon copy of you. God uniquely and specifically knit you together to fulfill His purposes and His plans for you. And not only did God create you to be a specific person in a specific place at a specific time with a unique destiny created for you, God has given you all that you need to become the best version of you that you can. And yet sometimes we still live in comparison. I wish I had what they had, and I wish I could do what they do. Can I just be honest and be frank with you for a minute? When we live in a place of comparison, to say things like, I wish I had what they had, and I wish I was placed where they've been placed, and I wish I had the positions that they've been given, what we're really saying is, God, you didn't do a good job. God, you let me down. God, I could be a whole lot better if you'd have given me what they have, what you gave them, what you did for them, where you placed them. What we're really doing is dishonoring our value for who God is to us by saying, God, you didn't do me right, you did them better. We've got to get to a place where we're living and following Jesus, accepting of where God has placed us, knowing that He's growing us, but He didn't ask us to be anybody else, to be in anybody else's race or anybody else's lane, but specifically designed us. Comparison is a thief of identity. So what then do we do? Like, if you're like me with this nature that's bent to compare, to win, to succeed, what do we do? How do we compare? How do we measure up? How do we answer the question of how am I even doing? I mean, there's got to be an answer, right? There has to be a rubric. There has to be a grading system, a scale, a timer, a shot clock, a scoreboard. There has to be something, right? And if you're like me, like, you just want that voice so desperately, you'll listen to the first voice you hear, which painfully for me is usually the voice in the back of my head. And that voice always whispers things to me like, you know, by this time in life, you should be doing a whole lot more like they are. And by this age, you should be a whole lot more successful like they are. And by this point, with this much experience, you should be to a place where they are. And I know that that's not true, and I know that's not the rubric I should go by, but for some reason, that voice inside my head is relentless. It wants to tell me, it wants to plead with me, you just need to keep up with their pace. You just need to keep up with what they are doing. And we go along this life and we try so hard to get on our bike and run our race, but we forget we're on the wrong bike. We're living in comparison. So we're trying to keep the pace. If I can just keep up, I'll take out a bigger mortgage than I'm supposed to, than I can afford, because have you seen the neighbor's house and my coworker's house? And I've got to keep the pace, and I'll take a bigger credit card loan out, or I'll get another credit card and extend to it because I just got to keep the pace. And I'll get my kid in every single travel sport that I can, because have you seen what they're doing for their kid and the opportunities they provide for their kid? I've just got to keep the pace. And we go through all these things, and then we convince ourselves, because my voice in my head is relentless, you just got to work a little bit more. You got to work a couple of, you got to get a side job so you got more money to keep the pace. And you need to take on a little bit extra so that you can just keep the pace. And before you know it, I'm working hard. I'm going through the right motions. I'm doing all the things that feel like I should be doing. I'm sitting on what looks like the right race. And I'm just not getting anywhere. I'm tired. I'm worn out. I'm exhausted. I feel like I should have gotten somewhere. And then the voice just chips in. And then we sit down to relax, and we turn on the TV, and we click through the social media, and we start to run through the feed, and we see that this family is now remodeling their bigger, better house, and they're doing these things, and they've gone to Target and Amazon to buy this for their backyard. And then Chip and JoJo, they got me all motivated to do the kitchen. Chip and JoJo, I love you. You're the best. Tone it down. You're breaking my budget here. Like, we do all these things that we just want to keep the pace. We just want to keep up, because if I fall behind, if I can't keep the pace, then I'm not going to live in the success that they're living, and I'm not going to see the happiness that appears that they have, and I'm not going to arrive to success like it appears that they have arrived to success. When we said this a couple times last week, we see social media, but we forget that this is a 14-second highlight of their week compared to the reality of my real-life documentary that took all of the days that felt like years. It's not a fair comparison, but we have this void. Because of the fall of man, because of the sin that separated creator from created, we have this void, and our longing for approval and our longing for acceptance and our longing for success, it can't be satisfied in anything other than God. But what we do is we try to chase everyone else down like they hold the key to our satisfaction, like they determine our level of success. And we get out of our lane and we look to the right and we look to the left, and like Peter did last week, we look behind us. What about him? Why is this different for me? mean, we even go as far as one time I was at a conference and I heard a motivational speaker say, and I thought at the time, wow, that's really powerful, profound. But the more I chewed on it, I thought, let me chew about that some more. He said, if you are so struck that you need someone to compare yourself to, then you just compare yourself to you yesterday. I was like, oh, that's good. That's real good. The youth ministry would go, You can say that. That's cool. Jesus honors that. Except for what if yesterday was really good and today's not being so good? What if last week was amazing and this week just doesn't keep it up? You can see where this comparison game, even when used to compare, to motivate ourselves to be a better version of me, spirals things like anxiety, depression, and low self-esteem, because if I can't keep up with yesterday, then today is going to be rough. Then this week's going to be rough. And this year is going to be rough. And you can see the swirl start to spiral. So what then we do? Last week we talked about Peter and John, and even though two of the closest disciples to Jesus still got caught up in this concept of the comparison trap, we got to look to the scriptures for the answers, because the Creator still wants to redeem and restore the relationship that we have with him. So Peter and John, they come along, and Jesus teaches them a really incredible lesson about, hey, stop worrying about him, stop worrying about them, and just focus, follow me. And then not long after that, a guy named Paul comes along. Paul comes along to be a powerhouse Christian influence. Paul wasn't always a powerhouse Christian influence. In fact, Paul, the guy who writes in the New Testament, Paul was actually a first century Jew, and not just a first century Jew, like an expert in the law who had taken the personal vendetta to eradicate the planet of the first century Christians. Like, this was Paul's mission. This is why I'm on the planet. And then God gets a hold of his heart. He has this encounter with God, and God changes his heart, changes his mind, which changes his life. And Paul goes on to powerhouse through and start and plant churches all throughout the Middle East. And he goes and he encourages and he visits and he writes letters to churches that are already in existence to try to grow them and build them up. In fact, some of the writings of Paul, some of the letters would be compiled and put into the New Testament. And Paul's writings make up almost half of our New Testament in the Bible. And this one particular letter we're going to dig in today is a very short passage, but if we could just catch it. You know what I mean? Like, when we understand something in theory, like, I get that, but it doesn't really affect me. If we could catch this to where what I know, now I know that I know. To where this doesn't affect in how I think, this affects how I live, how I function, how I operate in the gift and the call that God has given me to do. If we could catch this and settle this just in two short passages, two short just sentences, verses that Paul writes to us. If we could catch this, this changes everything about how I ride my race. This changes everything about how I see myself. This changes everything about how I, instead of looking around, I keep my eyes up on the one who created me. If you have your Bible and you want to turn to Galatians chapter 4. Now, Paul is writing this letter to a group of church folks in a province of Rome. That's very specific, and we'll come back and talk about why. In Galatians chapter 4, we're just going to start in verse 4. We're only going to make it through verse 5, but I'm telling you, these are good stuff right here. Verse 4, he says, but when the fullness of time had come, other translations would say, when the time was perfectly right, or when the time was just right, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law. Now, Jesus has quite the resume. Like, even as a non-believer, to look at the resume of Jesus's, like, actions and the things that he accomplished, the things that he taught, like, Jesus had quite the resume. But the pedigree, even of who Jesus was actually really fascinating and really important. I mean, Jesus, even in the Old Testament, was referenced as who he would be and who he would become and who he is. So we understand, like, the value of things like Paul would say, that Jesus is the Son of God, that Jesus is born of a woman, that Jesus was born under the law. Like, incredibly powerful, important statements. Why do those matter? Well, for one, for starters, Jesus had to be a man. In order to fulfill the requirements of the law, he had to be a human. He had to be a person. He had to be born of a human. He wasn't adopted into the family. He wasn't someone that was manufactured and built in outside of. He was born as a man. And on top of that, not only was he born as a human, Jesus was born to a Jewish family, which subjected him to be under the law, the connection, the covenant, the promise between God and his people, the law of the Jewish covenant, or the Old Testament, where we read it. God established this law, this agreement between he and his people. So Jesus, born as a man, under, subjected to the law, to make sure that we understand that Jesus was fully man. But Jesus wasn't just fully man, Jesus was also fully God. And I wrestle with this for a long time, because I subscribe to the you can't give more than 100% of anything and you can't be more than 100% of anything, okay? Like, one of my biggest pet peeves is when you're watching the recap of the game and the coach gets on to give the pregame or postgame interview and he says something like, well, you know, really the thing, the key for us tonight was Billy. Billy gave about 120% to the game, and if it wasn't for Billy's effort, we never would have won. Billy's out there giving 120% every day at work. He's giving all he can. And, you know, when he came through tonight, really showed up for us and we got the W. And I start yelling at the TV, Billy can't do that. He can only give 100%. That's not true. You can't give more than all of you are, and all of you is 100%. Stop lying. And this really gets me because Jesus was 100% man and also 100% God. And you can't be 200% nothing. But Jesus was. Jesus was 100% man. Jesus was 100% man. He was fully man so that he could meet the requirements of the law. He was fully 100% man so that we would know with certainty that Jesus has experienced it while he was on the planet. So that never would there be a day where you would pray and say, Jesus, you don't know what I'm going through. He'd been betrayed. He'd been abused. He'd been murdered. He'd been through all of the things that we could ever anticipate as poor behavior, poor feelings, poor experiences, so that he can relate fully to us, to feel the pain like we feel. You know what it's like sometimes when you want to comfort someone, but you just don't have the experience? Like, I don't know what you've been through, but I want to be there for you. Jesus experienced it so that he can be there for you and be relatable to you. But he's also fully God, fully God, fully man. Jesus was fully God in that he had all of the power, all of the authority, and all of the position of God, all the attributes of being God, fully God, fully man. He came fully God, fully man, to which makes him incredible. Jesus came fully human, which makes him relatable to us. He came fully God, which makes him reliable for us. Galatians chapter 4, verses 4 and 5. But when the fullness of the time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, verse 5, to redeem those who were under the law. And this wasn't like the law, like, hey, around here we go 45 miles an hour, not 46. You obey that law, you'll be just fine. Not like, hey, around here we don't lie, we don't steal, we don't fight. You do those things, you're going to be welcome here. It was way bigger than that. The law that Jesus referred to, that Paul referred to, was the agreement. It was the expectation for all of humanity, but specifically given to God's people, in that if they upheld the law while being subject to the law, God would bless them, protect them, and provide for them. If you do, then I do, and if you don't, then I won't. It was this incredible agreement, this old covenant that God had with his people, that they would follow the law. And here's where the argument comes in with non-believers oftentimes, is that, well, the law was just really behavior modification. God gave the law with consequences to make you do the things God wanted you to do. And there's some reality to that. Like, God knew what was best for you, and even though your feelings might take you differently, and even though pride and selfishness might take you a different direction, God did know what was best for you, and he was encouraging us to do the right thing. But the law is much more like an x-ray than anything else. An x-ray like of our morality, an x-ray of our spirituality. An x-ray, if you don't know, is when you go to the hospital while falling off of a bicycle with a possible broken arm. They'll stick your arm under a machine. I don't know, I've just seen this hypothetically. And they'll put you under this machine to see if there's anything broken on the inside. And the law actually was that very thing. It was this equipment, it was this tool, it was this metaphor, it was this expectation, it was this God-ordained covenant that would expose to us what's broken on the inside. And see, the thing is that most of us, we don't want to use what God has set as the standard, as the mirror or the x-ray to see that we're broken on the inside. What we want to do is use the comparison we have to other people to set the standard. The best example I can give is to the non-Christian who doesn't think Jesus is necessary. You see, I think that when I die, I'm going to get to go to heaven because I've been a good person. I've been better than most. When I think about people in this world who've done really bad, really poor things, really nasty things, I'm better than them. So I think being a good person, I'm going to qualify myself to go to heaven. The problem is, if I don't know if you saw this in the Tour de France, there was this one like invisible shield where like a whole bunch of bikers just all of a sudden just hit this wall and like 50 riders piled up on each other. And there was some pretty gnarly and pretty nasty injuries, some breakage of the bones. Like, it was a pretty big deal. Now if you and I were riding bicycles and we both fell off and we both broke our arms and your break is worse than my break, it doesn't mean that my break isn't broken. We live in this comparison world where if yours is worse than mine, then mine really didn't happen. That's not reality. That's setting the standard based on how we compare ourselves to other people's sin, how we think that our sin is. Just because I don't want my sin to be a sin doesn't make it less deadly. Just because my sin doesn't appear in my eyes as bad as your sin doesn't mean my sin has qualified me or doesn't disqualify me from the presence of the Creator. Sin disqualifies me from the Creator. From the broken bone is broken regardless of how bad your break is. And the brokenness on the inside of me disqualified me from the God of the universe. So when I understand that this brokenness, this I could not uphold the law, I could not fulfill the law, I could not maintain the law, I needed someone to save me, to heal me, to make me whole, it creates this different awareness of the gospel, that Jesus came to heal my brokenness, not in comparison to the standard of who I compare to, but in the standard of the holiness of God, who says, I demand perfection, and I have not accomplished that. I cannot obtain that. When sin entered the world, it destroyed, it broke the relationship between creator and created. And it left in the wake of this brokenness, this insecurity that I have, that I just want to measure up. I just want to be good enough. How do I do something to make sure I make the cut? When the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law to redeem those who were under the law. Admit it or not, faith background or not, religious or not, believer in Jesus or not, at one point, each one of us will be judged subject to the law. And God sent Jesus to redeem us from the judgment. That we were under the law, that we as humans of all humanity are under the expectation of this is how God expected us to live, and Jesus came to redeem me from the penalty, from the sentencing of me not being able to uphold it. Redeem, which is a pretty common word in the Bible, less common word in our world, but we still use it. Redeem is in your notes. Redeem means to purchase or to win back by means of a trade or an exchange. Best example I can think of, when your birthday rolls around, you get an email, and the email says, you receive a free appetizer. Take this little coupon, take this little code, and settle down for a Bloomin' Onion. And what do we think? Oh, a Bloomin' Onion. I think I'll go get me a steak and go with my Bloomin' Onion for free. So what do? We take the coupon, and we exchange it. They scan it. In the olden days when you had to print things, oh, man, forever ago, you would print it, and you would actually exchange. I'll give you this coupon, and I'll redeem myself a Bloomin' Onion or a really hot, awesome lava brownie cake with ice cream. Whatever it was. See, I'm hungry now. I can't make these statements this close to lunch. Like, I don't know if you've been like watching the housing market, but the past couple months, like the housing market has exploded. Like houses are worth more now than they've ever been before. So the question that I want to ask in this conversation of redemption is what determines what something is worth? What determines the price of something? What determines the value of what's being redeemed? Like if I'm going to get a Blooming Onion and the Blooming Onion is $10, I can very quickly determine that this coupon is worth $10 because I'm exchanging it for a $10 value. When I ask you like, okay, what makes a house worth as much as it is? We would say things like, well, the economy's gone up or the inflation's gone up or the amazing weather in central Indiana in February has caused the housing market to go up. Whatever you think the reason is, I'll tell you that it's actually simpler than that. It's not caused by anything other than the value of something is determined by what someone is willing to pay for it. The value of something is determined by what someone's willing to pay for it. The example being like you've seen somebody who tries to sell a car and they price it way higher than you would have and then 8 months later it's still for sale. It's not really worth that. My kids try to do this like, Dad, I saw this thing that I have on sale for like $1 million. Well, it's just because someone tries to sell it for that doesn't mean that that's what it's worth. It's actually worth 99 cents. Good try. Like just because it's priced there doesn't mean that's its value, but what someone's willing to pay, that's how you determine the value. So how do you determine the value when we talk about this in Scripture? The value of someone is determined by what someone's willing to pay for. Did you know that really the only way to get a full understanding of your value and your worth is if we had an auction? And we just marched every single person from Crossroads up on the stage. Hey, I'm going to do about three, number one, number five. That was the best I can do. The only way to determine your real value is if we auctioned you off. So back in junior year of college, I can't believe they did this, and I don't think it'll ever be done again, but this was a great idea. So there was this fundraiser. One of the organizations at the school I was at, junior year of college, decided we were going to make some money by doing a date auction. Now, if you don't know a date auction, it sounds terrible. A date auction is you would bring some volunteers up on the stage, and you would auction them off to the highest bidder to take them on a date. So people were paying money that would go to the organization in order to buy time with you. So my roommate and I were like, yeah, let's do it. It'll be fun. So we get up, and they say it was random. I say it was because they were leaving the best two for last, okay? I'm just throwing that out there. So my roommate and I go, we're the last two. I'm second to last. He's last. I get up on the stage, and if you were at the GLS this week, like, I was walking with my swag. Come on now. Where you at? And the girls were going crazy. Like, they're like, oh, he's so good looking. Like, I want to spout with him. And I was the highest bidder so far, $32. Somebody paid. Hold on. This is a long time ago. That's like a full tank of gas. Like, y'all laugh at $32. In my time, $32 went a long way. $32 was the highest bid of the night so far. I'm walking off the stage like, that's right. You're welcome, organization. I just got you money. And then my roommate walks up on stage. All of a sudden, I see negotiations happening over here. I see girls like, I will clean the apartment for the next 3 months if y'all give me this much money. This dude goes for like $200. Like 4 minutes, I felt so good about myself, and then, but we could tell. And as funny as it sounds, the only real way to tell the value of something is to find out the price that someone would pay. And as odd as that is and as crazy as that is, that's kind of the core of Christianity. The value of who you are has already been determined because you have already been purchased. Your worth, your approval, your acceptance has already been determined because of the value that was paid for you. You have been purchased. You have been redeemed. Not redeemed and purchased into something else, but redeemed and purchased into freedom. We were bound into slavery because we couldn't live up to the expectation and the standard. We were bound to sin, and Jesus came as a ransom to redeem us into freedom. You were bound under the law, and God paid the price with his perfect, his one and only son, that you would know freedom. God purchased you. He didn't put a sign in the front yard hoping that maybe someone would take a stab at it. He determined your value and said, I'll pay full price. I'm not negotiating. I'm not trying to get a good deal. I'll pay full price. God loved you so much, the God of the universe, that he paid the price with the sacrifice of his perfect son. That's your worth. That's your value. That's the price that was paid for you. And at the moment of redemption, when that exchange took place, it wasn't an estimate of how much you were worth. It was paid in full. Here is your value. God has deemed you so valuable that he sent his son to die in your place that you might be redeemed from the sentence and the consequence that you and I deserved. You've already been paid for. Last week we said that comparison sometimes polarizes us, that it either causes us to feel inferior, that we'll never add up, or that we're superior. Can I just talk to my sometimes battling with superior thoughts friends for a second? The price that God paid for you is the exact same price that he paid for everybody else that you know. And the price that God paid for you is the same price he paid for the person that you looked down upon earlier this week. God didn't pay a nickel more for you. You ain't that special. But God loves you just as much as he loves them. And God loves them just as much as he loves you. And he proved that by sending his son to take your place, to pay the price, to free you, to give you freedom. And all we have to do is accept that Jesus paid the price with his life to come into this world to win you back, to trade back for you. When the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, you and I, so that we might receive adoption as sons. Now, this statement right here doesn't translate really well into 2022. The statement of adoption, like, it would have been kind of confusing, specifically if Paul was talking to the Jewish folks. Like, in the Hebrew, like, grammar, there wasn't even a word for adoption back then. It didn't make sense. If somebody had a family member and their parents didn't make it or were able to survive or had to leave, it wasn't even a contest or a debate. Like, someone else in the faith would have absorbed them into their family. Some extended family would have just pulled the kiddos in and raised them as their own. Like, it wasn't even a concept. But Paul's not speaking to the Jewish folks. He's speaking in this Roman province. He's writing to this church in this Roman province where they actually had some context for the word adoption. But it's a little bit different than you and I see the word adoption. When we think adoption, we think of the family that swoops in and takes on that little baby, that cute little innocent precious baby, and they raise them up into their own until they get 18 or graduate, and then you do what you're supposed to do. You kick them out and you don't look back. They raise them up and they care for them for all those years. Or that precious little toddler with all this much potential, we swoop in, we adopt, we love, we care for. The tension, the battle, the goodness, the greatness, it's just like loving people. The thing is, like in Roman times, in generation one, in century one, this wasn't how adoption worked in Roman times. See, the struggle was, like, people didn't adopt babies back then. Because, I mean, it was, one, the reality of how do you care for and feed a newborn is nearly impossible if it wasn't yours. Number two, the death rate for infants was so large, it wasn't really something they thought of as worth the effort to put in to save them. And then the same thing kind of applied to toddlers. Like, toddlers are so much work. They got some sass in their pants. Like, they talk a little bit. They stink. And we're not really sure how you're going to turn out. So it's just not really worth the risk. Teenagers, even the same. Like, you seem like a lot of work. You back talk. I don't think it's worth it. So the first century Roman practice of adoption was usually adopting an adult, which seems really odd in our context. Like, why would you go about adopting an adult? I mean, adopting an adult actually came with some pretty good things. You didn't get the worry about what this adult would become. You could already get a pretty good track record. Like, you've been a pretty good adult the first couple years of your life, the first 20, 30 years of your life. How'd you like to be part of the family? Like, it's kind of an interesting, weird concept, but maybe the better place to example, or the better example I could give would be in the first century, Caesar Augustus. Maybe you've heard Caesar Augustus if you know the Christmas story. At that time, Roman Emperor Augustus Caesar put forth a decree that there would be a census in all of Rome. Mary and Joseph had to travel back home for the census. That guy. first emperor of Rome. Augustus really wanted to, now that he's the emperor, pass down his kingdom, pass down his emperorship down to one of his kids, except for he didn't care for his kids. He didn't want to pass it down to one of them, so he starts to look around at other options, and he realizes there are some really good people around me, and one of the people that emerged to the top was this guy named Tiberius. Tiberius was pretty pivotal in expansion of the Roman Empire that happened under Augustus's reign. So at some point along the way, Augustus adopts adult Tiberius. Tiberius was like 46 on Gotcha Day. Like, that is, what? Why would you adopt a 46-year-old? Ironically, I'll be up for adoption later this afternoon if you're not available. We'll just see how that goes. Anybody? Welcome. Maybe I can beat that $32. God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive adoption as his very own sons and daughters. And here's why I say all that. It wasn't that God sent Jesus to come down and adopt you, to bring you into the family as the baby, innocent, perfect little you before you made any mistakes. It wasn't that God said, I will pay the price for you, I'll make the exchange for you while you're that cute little toddler who's got all that potential in the world ahead of him. It was that God, knowing the full story of all that you've been, all that you are, and all that you will become, and God said, in spite of all those mistakes, and in spite of all those imperfections, I would love to welcome you into the fold. When Augustus adopted Tiberius, he became heir to the throne, to the empire. And God, knowing fully who you are and who you will be, knowing the mistakes you've made, the close calls you've had, and the ones that you'll still make, God willingly, without hesitation, sent his son to redeem you. A trade, an exchange, that you might be freed from sin, freed from the requirement, freed from your behavior will pay off, freed from comparison of how the people next to you are doing, free from trying to keep pace, free from trying to keep up, that you would know the Father as your Father, that you would know the God of the universe as your God, that you would be in relationship restored with him once again. How do you determine the value of something? By the price that someone has willing to pay. God considered you so worthy that he paid everything for a chance with you. That he sent Jesus to die in your place. That he sent Jesus to take the beating that we deserve, to take the punishment that we had earned, that we might know him. How do you break free from this comparison trap? How do you run this race that God has put in front of you without looking to the right or to the left or to behind? How do you get off the exercise bike and get into the race that God has set before you? You stop looking around at what everybody else is doing and you look up to what God has done. And when you keep your eyes on Jesus, he said it so simply to Peter, just follow me. It doesn't matter what he's doing. It doesn't matter what she's doing. It doesn't matter who's in this race. It doesn't matter if you can keep the pace. You run the race that God has called you to run, because God found you so worthy, so valuable, so important, so accepted, so loved, that he sent Jesus to die for you. Stop looking around and just look up, to keep your eyes on him. What do you have to prove? Your value is not found in what you do. Your value is found in that you are a child, an heir to the throne of the God of the universe. Your worth is not determined by what you have. Your worth is determined by who has you. Your acceptance is not conditional to what you've accomplished or what you will accomplish. Your success is conditional to the fact that you have been purchased. You have been redeemed, and it costs God everything, yet he never hesitated to say yes to you. Because you're worth it. Because he loves you. He invited you into his family to call you his own, to call you son or daughter. Your success is not measured in what you have. It's not measured in what you do. It's not measured in how you dress or what you've obtained. Your worth, your value, your approval, your success is a result of the one who made you, who called you, who loves you, who redeemed you, and said, welcome home. That's the good news. And that sets you free from comparison. Let me pray with you. Heavenly Father, I thank you for today. God, but more importantly, I thank you for this gift that you have given us, your grace, your love when we didn't deserve it. God, your forgiveness, the fact that you would send Jesus, perfect Jesus, to go in my place, that I would be redeemed, that I would be adopted into your family. God, I am humbled and I am grateful. God, don't ever let me forget the power of the sacrifice that you made that I might be redeemed. Jesus, I thank you for the things that you took from me and for me. I thank you for the guidance that you provide for me. And God, my prayer is that I continue to keep my eyes up to follow you. It's in Jesus' name. Amen.